National Trust Magazine, Autumn 2026.
Hello and welcome to the autumn issue of National Trust Magazine. I'm Sally Palmer, editor of the magazine, and I'll be taking you through some of the highlights, including news, features, and events to enjoy. There's nothing like nature to lift your mood and shift your whole day into a better place. It doesn't have to be much. Maybe it's a garden bird singing its heart out somewhere nearby, or a quick, thrilling glimpse of an urban fox. That's why I'm so delighted to bring you this issue's cover story, which celebrates the Trust's Window to the Wild initiative. Rangers and filmmakers have sensitively placed hidden cameras into nest boxes, seal colonies, beaver habitats, and more, streaming the footage online. Along with thousands of other captivated online viewers, I've watched entranced as eggs hatched, babies consumed vast quantities of snacks delivered by tireless parents, chicks fledged, and beavers sneezed. Head over to Windows to the Wild to see some of the year's highlights for yourself and discover whose daily lives will be coming online next. Also learn how these nature cams are playing their part in contributing to the Trust's work to restore nature, helping us all access moments like these, while inspiring millions more of us to care and take action to protect it. Here's Olivia Vinnell, Tatia Newell and Akia Henry to tell you about what's been happening around the Trust.
Building Arcadia. At Shugborough Estate in Staffordshire, an exciting new project is taking root. Known as Arcadia, part of the estate has been redesigned as a forest garden where every plant is a vital part of the self-sustaining ecosystem. Carefully planned pairings of mutually beneficial plants will allow the innovative garden to water and fertilise itself. It's a magic trick that helps build resilience against pests, disease and climate change. And it's not just clever. It's beautiful. Within the sanctuary of the Grade 2 listed walled garden, visitors will be able to weave through interconnected areas and learn about the more than 100,000 plants that make Arcadia's ecosystem possible, and how to apply the idea of forest gardening to your own green spaces. Arcadia will open to visitors in autumn 2026 as the Trust's first forest garden and the largest of its kind in the UK. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Shugborough for more information.
Going to Bat. A 19th century Gothic folly on the Petworth estate has been kitted out with a Thermocline hibernaculum, which makes a perfect pad for rare greater horseshoe bats. It creates stable climate conditions for their winter hibernation and summer breeding.
Watery digs. Over 150 water voles were released in North Devon in June, and 300 more were released into the North Wey River in the South Downs, thanks to a partnership between local people, landowners and organisations, including the Trust.
Pinehaven. Den boxes for pine martens have been installed at Stourhead in Wiltshire, and some of the elusive mustelids have already been spotted on the estate. The Trust is working with Wiltshire Mammal Group and the Vincent Wildlife Trust to monitor their presence, with the hope that they'll thrive here.
Fungi Future. A farm at Wallington in Northumberland will be the first site in the UK to trial an innovative, if unexpected, new carbon capture and food production technique. Known as mycoforestry, it could deliver carbon-negative edible mushroom crops. The project has already involved the creation of a new woodland thanks to support from DEFRA's Nature for Climate Fund. University of Stirling researchers inoculated many of the saplings with fungi spores, which will grow into mushrooms and work symbiotically with the trees. The fungi's mycelium roots help the trees to absorb more water and nutrients from the soil, and the trees provide fungi with carbon-rich sugars. The trees also absorb carbon dioxide, releasing oxygen back into the atmosphere and transferring carbon into the soil where mycelia act as natural carbon storage units.
Need to know. Get involved in your 2026 AGM. Your annual general meeting is a familiar fixture in the Trust's calendar, and we'd love you to be part of it again this year. The AGM will be held online and at the Steam Museum in Swindon on the 7th of November.
The AGM is your opportunity to catch up on the work we've been doing over the past 12 months, hear about priorities for the year ahead, and take part in decisions that help shape our shared future. Your voice matters, and the AGM is one of the most direct ways to make it heard.
You can have your say by electing members of the Trust Council, who in turn appoint the Board of Trustees and monitor and support the Board's work, voting on resolutions proposed by your fellow National Trust members, and asking questions, which can be done at the meeting itself if you're attending, or in advance by emailing agm@nationaltrust.org.uk. We aim to respond to as many questions as possible on the day.
How to vote. You don't need to attend the AGM in order to vote. Council election voting closes at 11:59pm on Friday, the 30th of October, and all election votes must be cast before then. AGM resolutions can be voted on in advance by the same deadline, or, if you attend the AGM, during the meeting itself.
The AGM booklet on our website contains information about candidates standing for election to council, and details of this year's members' resolutions on banking arrangements and the council election process. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/AGM or phone 0344 800 1895 to get all the information you need, including how to cast your vote, register to attend online or in person, this must be done in advance, and request a paper AGM booklet. Requests must be received by 5pm on the 9th of October.
And to stay in the loop, keep your email address up to date in my account to receive AGM and election updates direct to your inbox. Go to nationaltrust.org.uk/my-account-info.
And those were some highlights from the autumn news. Our next feature is from the Director General. Your chance to hear from Hilary McGrady.
As Director General, I'm not allowed to have favourite National Trust properties, but there is one that holds a particularly special place in my heart, and that's Crum. It's a cluster of islands, woods and ruins on the banks of Upper Lough Erne in Northern Ireland, and it's so beautiful that it feels like you're standing inside a picture book. No wonder it was chosen as the host location for this year's BBC Spring Watch. An amazing array of birds, butterflies and insects all call the island's home, as do a few very hungry pine martens. You might have even seen videos of its famous swimming cows on social media, and there are stories everywhere you turn. The castle survived two Jacobite invasions, just before accidentally burning down. And in the 1940s, the whole site was requisitioned as a base for US troops. It's one of those places that's awash with nature and with history. And we should have more of those. People need nature and culture, not just in wonderful oases like Crum, but in everyday life. That's what you tell me, and that's what many of you have been telling the government too, through our campaign, Nature Equals Future. We launched the campaign earlier this year to call on the government to restore nature faster and tackle unfair access to green space, and your support has meant the message is being heard. Thousands upon thousands of letters have been sent to almost every local MP in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Thousands more have gone straight to Whitehall, to the door of the Environment Secretary and to Stormont too. We're now speaking to MPs about what they can do for their constituents and to politicians about strengthening the laws that protect nature and enabling more people to have nature in their lives and enjoy it. People often ask me whether writing to your MP makes a difference, and I can tell you, honestly, it does. Since the campaign launched, we've seen money promised for threatened wildlife and a project to bring back the golden eagle, 150 years after it disappeared from our skies. We've seen a bill announced that aims to clean up our rivers, and we've heard the issue of access to green space debated in the House of Lords. It's not enough yet, but it's certainly a start. So thank you to everyone who wrote a letter, and please keep up those actions to support nature and culture, however large or small. It will take all of us to make a difference, and it won't always be easy. But the National Trust is in it for the long haul. As the adage goes, Rome, or should that be Crum, wasn't built in a day.
Thank you, Hilary McGrady, the Trust's Director General. You no longer need hiking boots, a snorkel, or a four-wheel drive to get closer than ever to the UK's wildest residents. Reach for the popcorn, nature is putting on a show. The feature is read by Olivia Vinnell, Tatia Newell, and Akia Henry.
Hearing about the rich and varied wildlife that exists in the far-flung corners of the UK is all well and good, but nothing beats seeing it with your own eyes, right? Too often, though, these remarkable moments are out of sight, unfolding under the cover of night, or simply out of reach, requiring a complex itinerary of planes, trains, and automobiles just to get close. In other cases, the sites themselves are simply too fragile or highly protected, requiring complete freedom from human footsteps for vulnerable species to thrive. Thanks to live stream technology, it's now possible to access the hidden worlds of some of the UK's most enchanting creatures. Our lenses play different roles. Some operate behind the scenes to help rangers solve challenging conservation questions. Some are set up for TV broadcasts, while others simply capture the nocturnal antics of species we rarely see, bringing joy to nature lovers everywhere. With 85% of the UK's population living in urban areas, many of us are a long way from seal colonies, remote sea cliffs, or secret woodland enclosures. But a new project has provided a portal into those hard-to-reach places. With the support of Bloomberg Philanthropies, this year the Trust launched Window to the Wild, a number of top-of-the-range wildlife cams. They've been bringing viewers online ever closer to the births, nesting behaviours, and species reintroductions happening year-round in our gardens, estates, and woodlands. Mobile vans took the experience a step further, streaming real-time nature feeds directly into bustling city centre streets around the UK for passers-by to marvel at for themselves. This autumn, more cameras are due to come online, so do look out for them whenever you have a need to step outside your day and into the world of a bird or beaver. In the meantime, let's look back at an incredible year of footage and see what amusing moments, crucial scientific findings, or unexpected dramas these windows to the wild managed to capture.
Puffins, May to July. With their brightly coloured beaks and awkward waddling gait on land, puffins are affectionately known as the clowns of the sea. The UK is home to about 9% of Europe's population, welcoming vast colonies back to its islands and sea cliffs each spring after a winter spent far out at sea. Severe population declines have landed puffins on the UK conservation red list. At Dancing Ledge in Purbeck in Dorset, a colony that numbered 40 pairs just 80 years ago has collapsed to just 3. While adults have been spotted courting, mating, and even carrying food underground, no pufflings, chicks, have left the nests in recent years. To try to understand the decline, we've installed motion sensor cameras on Dancing Ledge's sheer cliff face. Marine ornithologist Richard Caldo says, if we're to help this colony to survive, we need to establish what's going wrong. Puffins can live for 30 to 40 years, but with our current pairs likely over 20 years old, time is ticking. If they don't breed successfully, the colony could vanish completely. In 2024, volunteers combed through 70,000 camera images but found no clear culprit. Richard says, food shortages seem unlikely, as small fish remain plentiful and seabirds nearby are thriving. Our main suspicion is predation by rats or crows, which may be taking eggs or chicks. This year, the team upgraded to solar-powered cameras angled deep into the cliff's fissures. Because the remote site lacks a signal to live stream, rangers wait until after the breeding season to retrieve the footage and look for answers. About 350 miles or 563 kilometres north, the outlook is far brighter. The Farne Islands off Northumberland host one of the UK's largest colonies of almost 40,000 pairs. Their success is helped by the island's isolation, absence of ground predators, and scrupulous monitoring by trust rangers. Here, live cameras give the public a front row seat. First launched last year, the puffin cams streamed daily from May until the birds departed in July. This year, the Trust added a new burrow cam to reveal the hidden world of the pufflings, which remain underground until they are fledged. Because the Farns are a highly protected scientific and archaeological site, rangers couldn't disturb existing burrows. Instead, they built an artificial stone-covered burrow above ground. Though it was mainly used for naps this season, it remains ready for a new pair to nest in next year.
Beavers, March to October. It's the middle of the night on the Honeycutt Estate in Exmoor in Somerset. A squat, muscular beaver clambers out of a pond, unexpectedly loses its balance and topples backwards with a splash. Normally, its clumsy midnight tumble would pass unseen. But this year, the beaver's antics raised a smile for the thousands of viewers glued to Honeycutt's live stream online. It took a comprehensive health and safety assessment and a full kilometre of wire cable threaded through the remote Exmoor countryside from the beaver's enclosure to the Trust's estate office to run the live feed. The footage shows the positive changes the Honeycutt beavers are having on their landscape. Beaver Project Officer Jack Civita says, "As well as the beavers themselves, we've seen so many species on their camera, including otters, water voles and kingfishers. They're all benefiting from the beavers' presence. The other day, I even heard a cuckoo calling. I hadn't realised they were living in that part of the estate." Because of the way they can reshape their landscape, beavers are often described as ecosystem engineers. In the building and maintenance of their dams, they slow down water, which helps prevent flooding while locking the water in place to resist drought. Jack recalls, "During last year's dry summer, the beaver wetlands were the only deep water left on the estate. They acted as oases for other wildlife." Once widespread across the UK, beavers were hunted to extinction in the 16th century. But for some years now, conservation organisations, including the Trust, have been reintroducing them, taking advantage of the positive environmental changes they make. Following several previous enclosure releases at Honeycutt, this spring the team released a pair and family of four into the wild, bringing the estate's total population to 22.
Pied flycatchers, April to July. A fan favourite on BBC Springwatch in 2025, the charming pied flycatcher takes its name from its magpie-like plumage and acrobatic insect-hunting habits. These tiny birds travel thousands of miles from West Africa to nest in UK woodlands over summer. But breeding populations here have plummeted by over 50% in the last 25 years. While the UK's main populations are tightly concentrated in the wetter, oak-wooded western valleys of Wales and southwest England, Longshore Estate in Derbyshire has bucked the trend to become a surprisingly vital stronghold for the species. Longshore Ranger Mark Bull explains, "We manage the woodland to create more deadwood and potential nesting places. When we noticed their numbers declining in 2010, we began putting up more nest boxes and managing the woodland in a way we hoped would help. We now have 30 boxes spread across 6 different areas, monitored by a team of volunteers." To prepare for the breeding season, the team blocks half the nest boxes to prevent early nesting competitors like blue tits from claiming them all. Inspired by the public's enthusiasm for flycatchers through the Springwatch coverage, this year the Trust decided to install our own cameras into 4 boxes to keep the live stream action going. The camera soon captured some dramatic relationship dynamics. While the female worked tirelessly, the footage showed the male flycatcher was far less attentive, forcing her to leave the nest to hunt for herself. Mark explains, "The males do sometimes mate with 2 females. It could be he was too busy with his other female." Nevertheless, 6 chicks successfully fledged from the nest, contributing to the overall total of 200 to 300 pied flycatchers that fledge at Longshore each year. Alongside our entertainment, the cameras are also helping a research project with Liverpool John Moores University. The footage is giving scientists additional insights into nesting behaviour, and their findings will help the Longshore team discover how to better protect these global travellers for the future.
Barn owls, May to August. Famed for their heart-shaped faces and ghostly silent nighttime flight, barn owls are rarely seen up close in the wild. This summer's livestream camera gave viewers an intimate window into the hatching and development of fluffy owlets, chicks, at the Arlington Court Estate in Devon. Our glimpse into the nest box is the culmination of a major conservation success story. Since 2021, the estate's breeding pairs have risen from 2 to 3, with the average number of young fledglings nearly doubling. This mini boom is thanks to changes the trust has driven in land management. Reducing the numbers of grazing livestock has allowed grasslands and hedgerows to recover, boosting the populations of the voles relied on by the owls. Richer habitats have benefited kestrels and weasels too, and lured swallows, house martins and swifts back to parts of the estate from which they had previously disappeared.
Seals, November to January. Each winter, area ranger Eddie Stubbings prepares to move out of his home in the old lifeboat house at Blakeney Point, where he lives and works as part of a small ranger team. It's not the bitter Norfolk winter that drives him inland, but the colony of grey seals that comes ashore to give birth and breed. He says, they arrive in such numbers that the colony spreads right along the ridge, sealing off the point completely. By mid-November, the beach is so densely populated, it wouldn't be safe or kind to stay. The seals even pop underneath the house. Reducing the disturbance in this area is key to the colony's enduring success. Just 5 pups were recorded here in 1999. Today, around 9,000 are born each year. The seal breeding season follows a steady natural rhythm. Eddie says, each cow comes ashore to give birth and nurse her pup for around 3 weeks. Just before she leaves, a bull will mate with her. Then that's it. Parental duties are over. The pups linger a while longer, molting their white coats before heading out to sea. At the end of the dunes, the rangers have set up a solar-powered live camera in what will become the heart of the colony, ready to film the action. It's enclosed within a low, seal-proof barrier and built robustly to withstand curious and very heavy neighbours as it records mothers arriving, pups feeding and daily coastal life. Eddie says, we know how important the live stream became for people who aren't able to get out to these places. At Blakeney, where winter access is limited, it's wonderful for everyone to see exactly what's happening without disturbance, allowing the seals to thrive.
Red squirrels, December to March. The red squirrel is an endangered species in most of the UK due to the loss of its woodland habitats, but it's a different story off the coast of Dorset on Brownsea Island. Free of the invasive and normally dominant grey squirrel, Brownsea is one of the largest strongholds for reds in the south of England. A pine woodland sits at the island's heart, and the red squirrels feed on the seeds in the cones, spreading them as they go and regenerating the area. This winter, we're installing a live stream camera in a Brownsea red squirrel's dray, or nest, high up in the tree canopy close to the trunk. This is where they rest. And, in late winter, breed. Male squirrels engage in high-speed pursuits of fertile females in a practice known as mating chases, with spring litters born around March.
The stars of Springwatch, May to June. Throughout its 3-week broadcast from Crom in County Fermanagh, the BBC's Springwatch team hosted its live cameras online, with nests and woodland habitats beamed into people's homes for 15 hours a day. With around 100 people working on the production, Springwatch is one of the BBC's biggest outside broadcasts, with researchers monitoring the cameras morning and night, gathering wildlife highlights from the shores of Upper Loch Earn. On the live streams, viewers could track a stellar lineup of local residents: house martins, badgers, buzzards, pine martins, little grebes, warblers, robins, starlings, jackdaws, swallows, and great tits, enjoying a glimpse into their hidden habitats.
Otters, year-round. While many of the Trust's wildlife cameras are relatively new introductions, some have been in situ for decades. At Winchester City Mill in Hampshire, there's been a monitoring system in place for over 30 years, dating back to the 90s, when the Environment Agency installed the first cameras. The star of that show? The Eurasian otter, a species that has made a triumphant comeback across UK rivers after facing near extinction in the mid-20th century. In 2006, the City Mill team began maintaining and monitoring the otter cam more formally. There have been many upgrades to the camera setup since then. Motion-activated cameras now catch the otters in action as they emerge from under the mill at night, scurrying around to hunt for food in the wildlife-rich River Itchen. There's an underwater camera too, with eels, brown trout and ducks adding to the lineup. The mill's volunteers and visitors regularly enjoy the antics of the entertaining creatures who share their building, and the team shares otter cam highlights with an international audience on the mill's social media channels. As the river is an active otter corridor, there's plenty of action. Whether it's a late-night trout snack, motherly exasperation at a cub's clumsy antics, or a midnight cameo from a bat, the after-hours show never really stops.
You can watch the current wildlife cams at youtube.com/@nationaltrustcharity/streams. If you like, you can donate to the Trust's Window to the Wild campaign at crowdfunder.co.uk/window-to-the-wild. In March, the National Trust took over the management of the 10 museums, 550 hectares and 400,000 collection items that make up Shropshire's world-famous Ironbridge Gorge. Curator Lauren Collier explains why the immersive World Heritage Site is known as the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and sets out what visitors can expect next from this new chapter in its history. It's read by Akia Henry.
When Abraham Darby I arrived in Coalbrookdale in Shropshire in 1708, he kick-started a chain of events that transformed the small riverside mining settlement into the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. At the time, 100 years before the birth of Isambard Kingdom Brunel and 60 years before Richard Arkwright opened his first water-powered cotton mill, the UK's manufacturing industries were generally small-scale and localised, with the economy still largely based on agriculture. Darby was a skilled metalworker and an innovative businessman who learned his trade working in foundries in Bristol. He was drawn to Coalbrookdale because of the rich natural resources in the surrounding gorge, particularly coal, iron ore, limestone and clay, and the opportunity to lease a blast furnace. Within a year of arriving and establishing the Coalbrookdale Ironworks, Darby had pioneered an innovative new method of smelting iron using coke, a type of processed coal, instead of more expensive charcoal. Combined with his newly patented method of using moulds made of sand that could be easily mass-produced, Darby's breakthrough didn't just improve iron making, it changed the course of history. Iron products shifted from being scarce and costly to something that could be made cheaply, reliably, and in vast quantities. Thanks to Darby's innovations, it was now possible to build the machinery and infrastructure that would soon power the Industrial Revolution. Building on Darby's initial successes, his descendants branched out further. The Coalbrookdale Company produced iron products on a tremendous scale, beginning with the likes of cooking pots, iron rails, and stationary steam engines in the 18th century, and expanding to locomotives and decorative furniture in the 19th. In 1779 came the eponymous Iron Bridge, spanning the river just 500 metres downstream from Coalbrookdale. Designed by architect Thomas Farnells Pritchard and built by Darby's grandson, Abraham Darby III, the bridge transformed transport links in the gorge, connecting industries on both sides of the river and allowing both materials and the factory workers to move around more easily, while the River Severn carried the finished goods by boat down to Worcester, Gloucester, Bristol, and onto the rest of the world. With its pioneering design and construction, the graceful arch soon became a global advertisement for British engineering and the possibilities of cast iron. Industry thrived at Ironbridge Gorge for more than two centuries, but shifting markets and the rise of steel took their toll. By the late 1960s, the factories had largely fallen silent. Yet there was a growing fascination with industrial heritage. With post-war development erasing historic sites, Local campaigners recognised the gorge's importance and fought to preserve it. Their efforts led to the founding of the Ironbridge Gorge Museum Trust, IGMT, in 1968, followed by decades of excavation, acquisition and restoration to create the heritage site we know today. In 1986, Ironbridge Gorge was one of the first seven locations in the UK to be designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. English Heritage took over the management of its famous Ironbridge and still looks after it today. For nearly 60 years, IGMT cared for the gorge's museums, archives and collections. But by 2024, financial pressures and falling visitor numbers were threatening the future of the museums, and IGMT turned to the National Trust for help. The Trust receives moving offers from places at risk almost weekly, and much as it might like to, it can't accept them all. But Ironbridge Gorge was different. Teams at the Trust immediately recognised it as a vital part of the UK's industrial heritage that helped shape the world we live in today. Its unique collection of historic sites, with their pioneering living history approach, have captured the imagination of generations of people, helping locals and visitors alike to see that history isn't something that happened to other people in other places. It happened here. It's still happening here, and it belongs to them. The National Trust knew it was well placed to make sure Ironbridge Gorge's unique blend of living industrial history could continue. Support from the National Lottery Heritage Fund and commitments from the Department for Culture, Media and Sport and Arts Council England helped secure the funds to safeguard the site for the future, and the museums and collections passed into the Trust care in March. I've transferred across to the Trust after 8 years working for IGMT, and I'm now working together with other former IGMT staff and new colleagues from the Trust to revitalise and expand the experience of visiting Ironbridge Gorge. We're reopening the museums in phases, and there are currently four that you can visit, including Bliss Hill, a living, breathing recreation of a Victorian town. Walking through its streets, you might hear snatches of music hall ballads drifting out of the pub, or meet Constable Jarrett, the friendly policeman, on his daily rounds. Inside the printing shop, you'll find costumed interpreters at work on the presses. Follow your nose and it will lead you to the fried fish dealer on Canal Street, where you can tuck into fish and chips cooked in beef dripping and wrapped in newspaper. Ironbridge Gorge also helps to keep heritage craft skills alive. At Bliss Hill, for example, you'll find expert craft workers demonstrating trades such as tinsmithing, blacksmithing and decorative plasterwork. Chandlers make candles using a traditional nodding donkey, a rack which repeatedly dips hanging wicks into molten wax to build up layers. We have a dedicated costume team who design and make every garment worn by the interpreters from scratch, using historic patterns where possible. They produce a huge variety of outfits, from Quaker dress to Victorian bathing suits, along with the day-to-day work of repairing and laundering dozens of outfits. Although we do let them use modern washing machines rather than a Victorian washboard and mangle. All the experiences at Ironbridge Gorge are underpinned by extensive research. We have a huge collection, about 400,000 objects, spanning industrial life in the 18th and 19th centuries. There's also an enormous archive, covering the various industries that were based here and how they operated, as well as local history with photographs, oral histories and written accounts. There's a terrific breadth of stories, particularly working class stories, which is quite unusual for a heritage site, and I think is one of the most exciting things that Ironbridge Gorge brings to the Trust. The records of a stately home often focus on just one or two families, who are usually wealthy and educated enough to record their own stories and amass collections that tell us about their lives. The Gorge has a much larger cast of characters, from miners and potters to pipe makers and tile painters, whose histories are often under-recorded elsewhere. Ironbridge has the tagline of being the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, but that comes with the undeniable consequences that industry has had on trade and colonialism, nature and climate change. Being part of the National Trust means we've not only safeguarded Ironbridge's places, collections and landscapes for the future, We've also got a wider support network of other curators and experts with experience in researching and telling these broader stories. We're keeping the fan favourites. At Bliss Hill, you can still buy humbugs from the Victorian Sweet Shop and see George, the Shire horse, in harnessing demonstrations. But we'll also be listening to ideas and feedback from visitors and the local community, as well as new audiences, to find out what they'd like to see. The Gorge is still a place of making. One of the historic tile companies still leases part of its original factory from us. Our team still makes ceramics at Coalport, and we regularly run hands-on creative activities, workshops and demos across the sites. That's the beauty of Ironbridge Gorge. It's immersive, creative and alive.
Explore the Gorge. Here's a taster of the 10 museums that bring the history of Ironbridge Gorge to life. The first four are already open to visitors, with a phased reopening of the others over this year and next. Check the website at nationaltrust.org.uk/Ironbridge-Gorge for more details.
1. Bliss Hill Victorian Town. Originally an iron-making, mining and brick-making site, Bliss Hill was redeveloped between 1969 and 1973, and over the last 50 years has grown into today's bustling Victorian town. Many of the shops and cottages are historic buildings saved from demolition and moved brick by brick to the site. You can wander the streets, meet costumed characters, and experience what life was like in the 19th century.
2. Jackfield Tile Museum. Once the world's largest decorative tile works, this restored factory now showcases a vast collection of tiles and ceramics dating back to the 19th century. Many of the tiles on display were manufactured by Craven Dunnill or Moore & Co. Today you can learn how Jackfield tiles came to adorn grand buildings as far afield as Russia and the US, as well as local pubs and homes.
3. Museum of Iron and the Old Furnace. Head inside the Colebrookdale Company's great warehouse to discover how Abraham Darby I's iron smelting breakthrough helped spark the Industrial Revolution. Exhibits reveal Colebrookdale's global influence, from early rail lines and steam locomotives to ornate ironwork. Don't miss the remains of Darby's blast furnace, without which the world would look very different.
4. The Toll House. Take a stroll over the world's first iron bridge to the Toll House, which was still active until the bridge passed into public ownership in 1950. Today, it houses an exhibition explaining how and why the bridge was built and its transformational impact on travel and engineering.
5. Coalport China Museum. Step inside the original Coalport China factory, established by John Rose in 1796. For more than a century, its works were among the most successful of their kind anywhere in the world, picking up prizes at international exhibitions. When the museum reopens, visitors will be able to uncover stories of the craftspeople, techniques, and designs that made Coalport so successful.
6. Broseley Pipeworks. Broseley was once the site of the most prolific clay tobacco pipe makers in the UK, whose goods were exported around the world. Frozen in time since the pipeworks ceased trading in the 1950s, this time capsule factory offers a look into an industry spanning 300 years. It has tools, workbenches and moulds on display, along with different types of pipes, such as the churchwarden and Dutch long straw.
And for these four last museums, please check the website at nationaltrust.org.uk/Ironbridge-Gorge for specific details.
7. Darby Houses. This pair of elegant houses once belonged to the Darby family, and now offer a glimpse into 18th and 19th century Quaker life. Dale House was where Abraham Darby III planned the construction of the famous Iron Bridge, and has been restored to reflect that time period. Rosehill House recreates life in the 1840s and contains many of the Darby family's personal belongings spanning generations.
8. Ingenuity. Ingenuity is a hands-on engineering playground where families can experiment with machines, power, design, and invention. It also houses the UK's first Fab Lab, meaning fabrication lab, a small-scale digital manufacturing workshop available to hire, where people can learn and develop new products.
9. The Tar Tunnel. When this eerie 18th century underground tunnel was being dug as a canal tunnel, the miners instead struck a spring of natural bitumen, which still oozes from the walls today. At the time, bitumen was used to weatherproof ropes, cork wooden ships, and was even bottled as Betton's British Oil, an unscientific remedy for scurvy.
10. Museum of the Gorge. Once a bustling riverside warehouse, built for the Colebrook Dell Company and situated right in the heart of the gorge, just a short walk from the famous bridge itself. Discover how goods from across the gorge were shipped worldwide, putting Ironbridge Gorge firmly on the map.
As more trust libraries encourage visitors to sit back and relax with a book, could they help halt the decline in reading for pleasure? The feature is written by Karen Gregory and read by Olivia Vinnell.
The armchair is comfy, and piano music drifts in from the room next door as I lean back and leaf through a history of Britain. I'm in the library at Killerton in Devon, and I'm feeling right at home. Killerton's one of an increasing number of trust libraries where visitors are being encouraged to pause, relax, and use the room as it was originally intended. Where possible, there's a selection of books to browse. I've picked from a wide range of literature and history books here at Killerton. The plan is for more places to follow. Sarah Gooding, who has volunteered at Killerton for 9 years, says, "This library is so cosy. People have fallen asleep in here because they feel so comfortable. They often tell me they'd love to have a library like this, so it's great that they can share this one." The move towards opening up more trust libraries is timely, as 2026 has been designated the National Year of Reading. The initiative, led by the Department for Education, in partnership with organisations including the National Literacy Trust and the Reading Agency, aims to help tackle a sharp decline in reading for pleasure over the last 20 years. In 2025, only a quarter of boys and 39% of girls aged 8 to 18 said they enjoyed reading for pleasure, while 35% of adults surveyed by the Reading Agency in 2024 classed themselves as lapsed readers. The rise of smartphones, distractions from social media, and a lack of time are all likely to be playing a role. Given reading has so many proven benefits, from reducing stress and increasing empathy, and the ability to experience others' perspectives to helping children learn, its continued decline is a concern. Could trust libraries play a role in helping people to discover or reconnect with the joy of reading? It seems so at Killerton. Sarah says, "We see families here introducing their children and grandchildren to books they might have read as a child, like the old Blue Peter annuals and selection of pocket-sized observers books, or sitting in the corner and reading together. Other visitors might look at the shelves and think, 'When was the last time I read a book?' We often point them towards the second-hand bookshop on the way out." The hope is that such experiences can be repeated in more of the hundreds of other libraries in the Trust's care. Killerton is one of around 200 Trust properties, which together hold nearly 500,000 books and manuscripts. The collections include rare treasures such as the Sarum Missal, a prayer book printed by William Caxton in England in 1487, and on display at Lyme in Cheshire. The libraries of literary figures including Agatha Christie at Greenway in Devon, and the 20th century book collection of poet, novelist and civil servant Hedonbi Asalechi at 575 Wandsworth Road in London. Tim Pye, the Trust's National Curator of Libraries, says, "Books are the cornerstone of the Trust's collections. They aren't showy in the way that perhaps paintings or furniture can be, and I think that makes it easier for people to relate to them. Unlike other libraries, most of the Trust's books are still in situ and often contain things like inscriptions or notes in the margins. That means you haven't lost that very personal connection with the stories of how people used, read, and valued them. You can get right up close to the books at a Trust place, and I think that really helps people be inspired by the rich histories they can tell." These histories can be found in the grandest country houses and the smallest bookcases and help to tell the story of how reading and literacy developed across time. Large collections, like the 12,500 books and manuscripts at Blickling Hall in Norfolk, recall a time when only the wealthy could amass large quantities of books. They have plenty to tell about the lives and interests of this section of society and how they used their books. At Killerton, for example, a music book owned by Lady Henrietta Mary Erskine was dedicated to her by George Mann, a little-known 18th-century musician, in the 1790s, suggesting she was both his student and his patron. Tim says, "Occasionally you will find houses where there has been a bibliophile in the family who has gone out to find loads of really impressive books to put on their shelves, but the idea that books were bought by the yard simply to look good in the library is largely a myth. But I'd say the vast majority of the collections in trust libraries are publications that people wanted to read to get information or enjoy for pleasure, just like we do now." It wasn't only the wealthy elite who read and used the books in the trust's collections. At Townend in Cumbria, for example, the Brown family of yeomen or gentlemen farmers built a collection of around 1,500 books, including novels, poetry, and books on farming, religion, law, and medicine. Many show signs of being well-read, with turned-down pages, fingerprints, and annotations in the margins. The collection also includes several bawdy chapbooks, small cheap volumes containing risque stories or crass humour, made to entertain members of the working class. They would have been sold door-to-door in the 18th century by chapmen. By the 20th century, with the rise in subscription and public libraries and mass literacy achieved in the UK, books have become a major source of entertainment across the social spectrum. Cragside in Northumberland had a servants' library of over 200 books, likely assembled between 1900 and 1920, provided for the domestic staff who lived there. Traces of servants' libraries have also been found at Mottisfont in Hampshire and Baddesley Clinton in Warwickshire. In 1900, a workers' library was established at Quarry Bank in Cheshire, containing over 400, largely fiction, titles that workers could borrow for a small fee. From the records, it's possible to piece together insights into the lives of the cotton workers, manual labourers, domestic servants, clerks and teachers who used it. Take Phoebe Whittaker, a 16-year-old cotton weaver who read a wide range of fiction by authors such as Edna Lyell, a bestseller of her day. The records show Phoebe often borrowed the same books as another 16-year-old, Lily Bone. Perhaps they were friends, or visited the library together. Another young borrower, a clerk called Ezra Tunnicliffe, seems to have preferred adventure stories and books with heroes like Baroness Orksey's The Scarlet Pimpernel. Ezra's lending record stops in 1914, when he became a private in the army, but later records show he survived the war. Today, visitors can see a selection of books from the Workers' Library on display at Quarry Bank, helping to paint a vivid picture of working life in an early 20th century industrial community. These hugely varied libraries and collections tell stories of people who, regardless of background or time, had that same need for storytelling and knowledge we can look for in books today. Despite concerns about the decline of reading, the Publishers Association says publishing continued to grow in 2025, with total publishing revenue standing at £7.4 billion. The Trust itself publishes around 25 beautifully illustrated non-fiction books each year, including children's books, guidebooks, and books on nature, heritage, gardening, walking, and travel. And, of course, there's the rise of the BookTok community on the social media platform TikTok and the growth in audiobooks over recent years. Maybe what we are seeing is simply another evolution in the long history of reading. Tim says, "We're thinking about how we can responsibly make that leap from people being able to browse and get up close to the books to actually getting them off the shelves. Back in 1909, when the very first books were brought into the Trust's care at Coleridge Cottage in Somerset, the idea was that it would be a place for people to go and enjoy reading. We're still grappling with the balance between access and conservation, but we're working towards curators being able to identify books which could withstand more use so that we can bring them off the shelves for people to look at. We've also trialled digital solutions where people can virtually pick a book up at places like Wimpole in Cambridgeshire. Back in Killerton's library, I can sense the generations of the Ackland family who once lived here. Perhaps Sir Richard Ackland, who, in line with his political principles, passed on Killerton to the Trust for everyone to enjoy, is reading over my shoulder. Sarah says, I think he'd have been delighted to see people still reading here. The history of reading and books is long, but I'm excited for the next chapter.
Stop, read, relax. Discover more Trust places where you can kick back with a book.
Belton House in Lincolnshire. Relax on comfy sofas and armchairs with cushions and blankets and a selection of books to read in Belton's library. Watch out for Book Discovery Days, where books from the collection are laid out for visitors to enjoy up close with conservation volunteers and partners from the University of East Anglia.
Blickling Hall in Norfolk. Blickling Hall's collection of around 12,500 books is one of the largest in the Trust care. Today, visitors can wander along the book-lined long gallery or stop and relax on cosy sofas, where a selection of books is usually available to read in peaceful, distraction-free surroundings.
Lyme in Cheshire. The Sarum Missal, or service book for the Catholic Mass, is the only surviving book of its kind. You can leaf through a facsimile of the Missal and see the original, then borrow a book to sit and read in the library.
T. Mawa Wibbernant in Conwy. T. Mawa Wibbernant is the birthplace of Bishop William Morgan, the first person to translate the entire Bible into Welsh. Today, you can sit in a beautiful custom-made walk-in pod called Eclifgath, the library, and interact with a growing collection of foreign language Bibles.
Wallington in Northumberland. The library at Wallington includes the collections of the Trevelyans, a family of radical liberal landowners. Many of the books contain their annotations. After you've seen the library, head to the reading room with its dedicated children's book nook and get lost in a book.
Discover other places in Trust care with literary connections at nationaltrust.org.uk/literary-connections. Trees of Hope. The illegal felling of the iconic Sycamore Gap tree has led to a new beginning, 49 times over.
Last autumn, 49 sycamore saplings set off from a secret location in Devon. Some travelled hundreds of miles, destined for new homes as far afield as a small community hospital in Orkney, an ancient orchard in Cambridgeshire, an urban park in Bath, and a horticultural college in Swansea. Each has a unifying theme: hope in and for the natural world. These saplings are the Trees of Hope. 49 trees grown from seeds collected from the original Sycamore Gap tree in Northumberland, following its illegal felling in September 2023. People from around the world united in person and online to express grief and outrage, but they also shared ideas for how the tree's legacy might live on. A year later, the Trust announced that organisations and individuals could apply to offer a home to one of 49 saplings, one for each foot in height of the original tree, to plant in a publicly accessible space as a symbol of hope and renewal. More than 500 organisations and individuals applied, and after 2 years of nurturing at the Trust's Plant Conservation Centre in Devon, in autumn 2025, the saplings were strong enough to plant out. Communities at the 49 chosen sites around the UK planted their Trees of Hope, reflecting on what the tree and nature means to them. As well as the Trees of Hope, each of the UK's national parks has been given a sapling from the tree, creating a living legacy network. The Trust also presented a sapling to His Majesty the King, our charity's patron, to plant in Windsor Great Park and to the school closest to the site of the original tree, in recognition of its importance to its local community. Part of protecting the fallen tree's legacy was deciding what to do with its wood. The largest intact piece is now on permanent display at the SEAL, National Landscape Discovery Centre, which is part of Northumberland National Park. Other smaller pieces of wood have been used in art projects, such as printmaker Shona Branigan's heartwood prints, created using a 90-centimetre disc from the trunk. In May, following a public vote and final decision by an expert judging panel, the Trust revealed the winners of the Sycamore Gap Wood Commission. Arts charity Helix Arts and George King Architects will create a shared living artwork called The People's Tree. They are inviting people to send in recordings, sharing personal connections to trees. They'll also record a digital soundtrack of the Sycamore Gap Tree by scanning the tree's rings, turning its history into sound. Together, the works will form a series of exhibitions, culminating in a sound sculpture near Hadrian's Wall. At the site of the original tree, new shoots growing on the stump hint that in time, the tree could regenerate. One day, a legacy sycamore might stand in the gap once again. While we wait, the 49 Trees of Hope will continue the story it began.
Cornwall Partnership NHS Foundation Trust's Healing by Nature project uses nature to support people through mental health challenges. They say, "We see every day how nature supports well-being and helps reduce anxiety, stress and depression. We planted our sapling at our Trevillis site in Liscard, where we're developing an outdoor well-being space. The tree will anchor the space, which is designed for activity, reflection and recovery, helping us embed nature at the heart of how we support mental health. Planting the sapling felt incredibly special and symbolic. We held a small ceremony and a group member sang a song she wrote after attending our group and spending time in nature. It was an emotional and powerful moment that captured the spirit of healing by nature beautifully." The people involved in planting the tree still feel a connection. During hot weather, members of the team have watered and cared for it, and we've been pleased to see new shoots as it settles and grows. It already feels like an important part of the space and the community around it.
Coton Loves Pollinators is a grassroots village group in Cambridgeshire that brings local people and businesses together to create nature corridors. They say, "One of our members grew up near Sycamore Gap, and the tree threaded itself through many of their life's important moments, childhood walks, trips home, then later taking their own children there. For them, as for many others, it was never simply a tree, but a landmark of memory and belonging. We planted our sapling at Coton Orchard, where we have created a story orchard filled with what we think of as living bookmarks, trees planted to hold memories, histories, and acts of hope. The sapling seemed destined to find its place among them. We marked the moment with a community event for local people, and Sarpatha Dasgupta, economist and president of the Wildlife Trust for Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire, and Northamptonshire, planted the sapling in its new home. Receiving the sapling felt strangely moving. A small thing, easy enough to carry in your hands, yet heavy with the sense of what had been lost and what might still endure. Planting it became less an act of replacement than of continuity. It's a refusal to let destruction have the final word."
Find out more about the Sycamore Gap Tree and its legacy at nationaltrust.org.uk/Hadrian's-Wall. George Clark believes in the power of planning. Revisiting the utopian, nature-led new town of his youth, the architect suggests how we might build better neighbourhoods for everyone. The feature is read by Tatia Newell.
George Clark has risen to become one of Britain's best-known architects. On a string of hit shows for Channel 4, he works wonders, transforming everyday homes into attractive, eco-friendly living spaces driven by his abiding belief that good design can change lives for the better. Much of this stems from his early years growing up in a council house in Washington, a 1960s new town in Tyne and Wear. George says, "Washington was revolutionary in its day, a a utopia for my parents moving in from the cramped terraces of inner-city Sunderland. In less than a decade, a team of designers and landscape architects created this state-of-the-art town from scratch. They built housing for 50,000 people with all the transport, parks, shops, and doctor's surgeries they would need. It was a lovely place to live. George, who is also a National Trust ambassador, says, "The town inspired me as an architect and shaped me as a person. The vision behind the place was radical and the town planning was deeply humane. Our new estates were designed as a series of villages, each with its own primary school, corner shop, pub, and village hall. His walk to school was just over a kilometre and didn't involve a single road crossing. I picked up friends along the way. We all walked. The homes were spacious, with plenty of green space. My mum's house is two stories with four bedrooms and a front and back garden. All the houses look out on a courtyard square with the cars parked round the back, away from where we played. The sense of community was off the scale. Everything was so lush and green too. They did a great job with the landscaping." As the government pledges 1.5 million new homes to address the UK's housing crisis, George's personal perspective on what makes a successful urban neighbourhood couldn't be more relevant. With 21st century new towns planned for seven sites around the UK, the urgent demand for housing arrives against a backdrop of climate change and nature loss. This is often compounded by political rhetoric that paints the environment as a blocker to development, a narrative that conservation organisations like the Trust are fighting hard to contest. Georgina Holmes Skelton, the Trust's head of public policy, says, "We think it's false to say you can have growth or nature, but not both. Green space isn't a luxury. It's a human need, benefiting physical and mental health. Biodiversity has proved to be fundamental to a nation's long-term economic prosperity. Research from the Green Finance Institute suggests that damage to the natural environment could cause a 12% loss to UK GDP, a steeper decline than that caused by the pandemic. While 80% of British people live within 15 minutes of a decent-sized green space, this figure plummets to as low as 1% in the country's most disadvantaged urban areas. As a recent Trust-backed report warned, many first-time buyers are effectively being forced into nature deserts, a symptom of a long-term failure by governments to create greener, healthier, new-build developments." George echoes the Trust's call for nature to be planned into housing developments before a spade hits the soil, prioritising the preservation of existing habitats wherever possible. He recalls, "In Washington, it felt like greenery and wildlife were all around us. It was integrated into the original design. Ponds and waterways ran through the town where we'd find tadpoles, mice and voles. There were plenty of birds too, thanks to the hundreds and thousands of saplings planted there. Those trees have since matured over the years. If you look at Washington on aerial imagery today, it looks like a forest." George sees parallels between today's generation of young adults shoehorned into pricey private rentals and that of his parents, rescued by the new towns from the decaying industrial slums of post-war UK. He is unimpressed by the house-building policy of recent decades, with its piecemeal approach and legacy of bland, edge-of-town estates designed mainly to maximise profit. He says, "These places look like a handful of monopoly houses have been thrown down willy-nilly, devoid of the vibrant social amenities that made Washington a success. Nature is often an afterthought, a token square of grass rather than an integrated part of the landscape." George believes house buyers deserve more for their money, and there's a lack of guidance for the big house builders. They don't invest in suitable architects, and local authorities don't have a coherent plan. He points to the Duchy of Cornwall's housing developments at Poundbury in Dorset and Nansleddon in Cornwall as Back to the Future blueprints for a better solution. Both developments are founded on New Urbanism, an American movement that promotes environmentally friendly habits by creating walkable districts with a range of housing, an onus on bikes and buses over cars, and a commitment to jobs on the doorstep. George says, "They rediscover some of the principles of good urban planning that we've lost in this country. Nansleden is a simple village model with pedestrianised avenues, places for people to come together, and beautiful parks. Not every building is to my taste, but who wouldn't love to live in a well-built Georgian home? There's a reason that style of architecture has stood the test of time. Of course, the monarch can't bankroll every modern mass housing project, and the green new settlements of the 1960s were pump-primed by major public sector investment. Washington Development Corporation was mandated to buy land at agricultural prices, which made for healthy profits as soon as it was developed. In the past, major projects like Milton Keynes were self-sustaining, funded by endowments that still maintain the city's forests, lakes, and parks to this day, with green space occupying about 25% of the city. In an age of tightening public purse strings, and with the government demanding an ambitious density of properties built on each plot of ground, Georgina accepts that most new housing will continue to come from smaller-scale private schemes. She says, "But even modest pockets of nature can be meaningful if they link together well, creating green corridors for the well-being of people and wildlife." The Trust is calling for planning authorities to make use of new strategic planning powers to think holistically across towns and cities, finding the areas of public space that already exist and seeking to expand and enhance it. Georgina says, "We've seen it work in places like the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in East London, where the River Lee was cleaned up and used as a backbone for a joined-up network of green spaces. They are cherished because they serve different community needs, whether for sport and exercise, children's play, outdoor gatherings, or gentler contemplation in nature." One trust project seeking to move the dial is the Eight Hills Regional Park between Birmingham and Bromsgrove. With the area facing growing pressure from both development and visitor numbers, the Trust is working with partners to join up green spaces, with future house building contributing to their creation and upkeep. Hannah Sargent, the Trust's project lead, says, "This patch is pretty typical of lots of urban fringe landscapes, and we hope our plans can be replicated elsewhere. We're looking to link up public transport, walking, cycling, and horse riding routes so city folk can get into the outdoors, and we're incentivising farmers to open new footpaths that will make it easier for people to access nature closer to home." The same thinking lies behind Nature Towns and Cities, a coalition launched by the Trust with Natural England and the National Lottery Heritage Fund, which aims to give 5 million more urban dwellers access to nature over the next decade. For George, green planning begins on a small scale. He says, "Nature should be hardwired into everyday life, with green roofs, roadside rain gardens, and vertical planting on the walls. We should have pocket wildflower meadows, beehives, and allotments. If planners are worried about the long-term maintenance of green spaces, they should rally the community to help care for it. They'd rise to the challenge." He believes we should invest in developments that last, working with nature rather than against it. "That's what I grew up with in Washington, and with the right ambition, it's within our grasp today."
Before we wrap up this edition, it's time to hear about some of the events going on at National Trust places this autumn. Booking is essential for many of these activities, and some cost extra. So please make sure to check individual property web pages or call the property for the latest information before you visit.
Heritage Open Days. Heritage Open Days returns from the 11th to the 20th of September, celebrating history and culture across England. This year's theme of Everyday Histories shines a light on the routines, crafts and trades that defined our ancestors' lives. Lots of heritage sites open their doors, free of charge.
Many trust places are taking part, including Petworth in West Sussex on the 12th and 13th of September, where visitors can explore the house's extraordinary art collection and current exhibition, Expressions in Blue, Monumental Porcelain by Felicity Ayliffe.
Or be transported back 500 years at the moated manor house of Baddesley Clinton in Warwickshire on the 13th of September, before exploring the walled gardens and estate set in the peaceful forest of Arden.
Heritage Open Days is brought to you by the National Trust with funds raised by postcode lottery players. Find events near you at nationaltrust.org.uk/heritage-open-days.
Apple Days. Celebrate the apple harvest and sample some heritage varieties at a trust orchard near you.
At Acorn Bank in Cumbria, celebrate the season with a series of apple-themed experiences from the 5th of September to the 27th of October. At weekends, you can sample freshly picked fruit from more than 175 heritage varieties.
At Barrington Court in Somerset, drop in during Harvest Week to learn more about the orchards, meet the rangers, and discover how the fruit is gathered and sent off to make cider.
Or at Shaw's Corner in Hertfordshire on the 18th of October. Step into George Bernard Shaw's beloved orchard for a day of tours, tastings and family fun. Sample more than 20 heritage varieties and chat to the senior gardener about orchard care.
Diwali, Corf Castle in Dorset. On the 25th of October, join Corf Castle's After Dark Diwali celebrations with a light trail, Rangoli artworks, live music and dance, Indian food stalls and craft activities. Co-created with the Bournemouth Pool and Christchurch Indian community, the night will culminate with a diyar lighting ceremony, with visitors invited to light clay oil lamps, symbolising the triumph of light over darkness. Booking is essential.
This year's Diwali celebrations at Dunstable Downs in Bedfordshire will be brighter and more colourful than ever. Everyone is welcome to come and join in making Rangoli art, making and lighting diyar oil lamps, and crafting marigolds, which are traditional decorations for festive occasions in India. There'll also be music, dancing, henna, and special Diwali treats available from the cafe.
At East Riddlesden Hall in West Yorkshire, and running in partnership with Bradford Hindu Council from the 6th to the 11th of November, the lower floor of the hall will be decorated with lamps and handmade paper flowers. Listen to traditional Indian music played on the flute and tabla hand drums. There will also be puppet shows and storytelling led by the local Hindu community.
Festive cheer. Hilltop in Cumbria. A Hilltop Christmas tale. Step inside Beatrix Potter's beloved farmhouse between the 7th of November and the 13th of December to find Christmas decorations straight from a storybook with lights, music and playful touches inspired by her characters.
At Polston Lacey in Surrey, celebrate the 12 days of Christmas between the 21st of November and the 3rd of January, where lavish immersive displays and sparkling trees decorate the house, themed on the 12 days of Christmas. Admire the 6-metre or 20-foot Christmas tree, follow the children's trail around the grounds, and pick up a festive treat in the cafe.
Or at Longshaw in Derbyshire. Enjoy a nature-based Christmas at Longshaw, with a children's deer trail around the woods, crafts and wreath-making. Take your little elves to meet Father Christmas and buy a Christmas tree to take home.
Winter lights. Light up the dark winter nights at a Christmas illumination event. At Stourhead in Wiltshire, light installations including a sea of light, fire garden and winter cathedral will be set against the backdrop of the Palladian Gardens.
Step into a winter wonderland at Wimpole in Cambridgeshire with its illuminated trail and festive food and drink. And at Belton in Lincolnshire, expect twinkling lights and immersive seasonal sounds. Find winter lights near you at nationaltrust.org.uk/winter-lights.
Snowdrop spotting. Don't miss our snowdrop displays. They're at their best in January and February and are a reminder that spring is not far away.
At Baddesley Clinton in Warwickshire, the Baddesley Clinton gardeners began planting a new snowdrop woodland last winter thanks to a kind donation from the South East Staffordshire National Trust Association. Over the next 10 years, hundreds more bulbs will be planted here.
At Kingston Lacey in Dorset, find a bench along the twisting paths of the fernery to enjoy views of the rustic raised beds, which burst with 35 different varieties of snowdrop in January and February. Continue on to the Lime Avenue for more snowdrops.
At Bodnant Garden in Conwy, Bodnant's display of snowdrops gets more impressive each year thanks to their annual planting of new bulbs. The first appear in early January, and by the end of February, thousands blanket the old park.
and towards the end of the winter at Wallington in Northumberland, Wallington's woodlands become a carpet of delicate white snowdrops, 1 million of them no less, which dedicated gardeners, volunteers and visitors have planted over the last 10 years.
Find more snowdrop swathes at nationaltrust.org.uk/snowdrops. And for all the events just mentioned, plus plenty more to do near you, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/what's-on. Well, that's all from us this autumn issue. I hope you've enjoyed it, and do let us know what you think of this audio edition. You can email us at magazine@nationaltrust.org.uk. The National Trust Magazine Autumn 2026 was presented by me, Sally Palmer. The readers in this edition were Akia Henry, Tatia Newell and Olivia Vinnell. It was produced for National Trust Magazine by Sound Understanding, and all items are copyright. CDs of this audio edition are available to members of the National Trust who are blind or partially sighted and are distributed by the RNIB. If you know of anyone who is eligible and would like to receive them, please call the RNIB on 01733 375 370. Or you can write, enclosing the membership number, to Sales and Operations, RNIB, Northminster House, Northminster, Peterborough, PE1 1YN. This audio magazine is also available to download or stream as a podcast. You can access this and previous issues free of charge from wherever you usually get your podcasts. For more information, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us for the next audio issue of National Trust Magazine.